Yes.
Just one additional comment and a response. We appreciate the concurrence with the toil that we've put in to try to focus this on symptomatic as opposed and to take the emphasis away from asymptomatic bacteria. And this was one of the areas that we focused so intently on that caused a little bit of a delay for the manual. So it was well intended.
And I think it's really important that you did that. I think that's very, very important.
One issue on the horizon in terms of harmonization is we're about to embark on our large HAI project this year, actually in the next couple of months, and CDC is submitting an updated case definition and measure to NQF around UTIs, especially catheter-associated UTIs. So I think we'll just need to make sure we harmonize that going forward. That won't be endorsed for at least 9 months, but I think it's an important future thing to make sure the same rates of UTIs we've got in hospitals, we should really be defining in the same way.
But it's really important as we do that, because I work with CDC every day, but also bridge into the geriatric world. CDC defines UTIs in the young people, and it's clear what you're hearing here is it's very different in the elderly. And this issue came up on the ambulatory, the geriatric, the geriatric measures panel that I was on. We've talked a lot about the same thing with that. So, what I hear before us is approve the measure, close the loophole, missing data, and then for the vendors and the development, I don't hear anything else. I do have I'm going to summarize this in a recommendation back to CMS, though, but approve the measure with the closing loophole and missing data. Mm-hmm. You have a pained look on your face, Rob.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. It's a happy time. We're going through the measures. No pain on there. Okay. We did the pain yesterday. We got that done. Yeah. Well, no, if you vote on this measure, you can go and not be incontinent.
Good bladder health.
Yeah, no, okay. I have an indwelling catheter.
any abstaining? Any opposed? All in favor? Okay. The recommendation to CMS is, again, to Gene Scott and everyone else, the RAPs and the FTAG need to really be improved, probably on this very issue of overdiagnosis of UTI, and it needs to be done in a way that empowers the medical director and the nursing staff to take on my colleagues, who are the ones who really are ordering the urinary cultures. Then, as soon as they see the bacteria, they feel compelled to treat.
Well, and it also needs to harmonize to the never event in acute care. So the fact that patients who are admitted to us in acute care settings, if they develop an iatrogenic urinary tract infection that will not be covered under payment by CMS, that all has to be harmonized in this. So,
I mean, the big problem is you need to empower the nursing homes to take on the doctors, because there's a synergy between the nurses and the doctors here. The nurses feel compelled to do something. The doctor says, we'll just order a urine, and it starts a cascading event. The urine comes back abnormal. The doctor says, then give them an antibiotic. The calls stop. Everyone's happy, except the patient's the one that's harmed on the whole process. So, but until you're in a position to help break it and work with the state survey agencies, the reporting and payment and linking it all together, I think this will be very powerful.
And that plays into overuse of antibiotics, too, in the elderly population.
Exactly. All right. We finished incontinence. Please, no one be incontinent. Use the bathrooms. And we're back here in 15 minutes.
What was that thing?
Hi.
Okay. We'll go ahead and get started. Yeah. All right. I move we approve all three measures as is. Everyone in favor? Okay, you guys can go. We're done. The quorum at the beginning of the meeting. You don't have to have a quorum throughout the whole meeting. I've used that technique before. Okay, so what we need to do now reflect back over the measures we've done. I'm just filling the time. If I talk, they'll come in and they'll do it faster. If I don't talk, they won't. So reflect back over the measures that we've done so far. and what we've passed and haven't passed. Okay. Okay, so a couple quick announcements. I was just talking to Phil at the time. You sit down when I talk. So show of hands of people who need to take the shuttle to National Airport for the 2:30. In the back two. Yeah. Yeah, just so we got to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six people.
Okay. I don't know if you counted me. It might be seven.
Yeah, I counted you.
Okay.
Did I miscount? Is it seven? Show of hands again. I clearly can't count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, six. Okay. And then, why do you want to know about BWI?
They might be able to arrange another shuttle.
Oh, how many people are going to BWI?
I am the only one who saved NQF the big bucks by flying the cheap airline.
All right, if we're doing one ups, I drove.
Oh. You win the prize. I defer.
Is there a chance we're going to end early?
Yes.
We can always hope. Okay. on the issue that Helen brought up last time, the two measures that we approved, the two incontinence measures, in the past, there was a recommendation from NQF that those measures always be used together because of the potential for gaming. That kind of like what we said before, if you you can put a lot of catheters in a lot of people to get out of the exclusion for the other. So when the measures, when the exclusions in one measure are used and can get you out, yet it is also a quality measure elsewhere, there's usually been a recommendation to pair those two. So what it would be is that the low-risk bowel and bladder and then the use of the catheter, those two would be paired together. I would ask, do you think that the UTI should be paired as all three or they could be done that? The other two we didn't approve, so it would just be those two. Comments on whether they should continue to be paired or not. They currently are paired. All right, so I had not any comments or questions about it. So,
what do you think?
I just do what I'm told. So I would put forth to the committee that they be paired. That's probably what I think, Bruce. They should be paired.
Could we ask the developer, should they be paired?
Yes.
Yes, we agree that they should be paired.
I move that we
both be paired. Just a question in relation to that. Not to be overly simplistic, but does the paired mean just reported in proximity, or does it mean some explanatory commentary?
I think the explanatory commentary and other stuff is up to the different people who use it, but it's just that we're saying that if someone's going to use it, essentially we're endorsing them almost as a single measure. They have to be done together. You can't. Someone's going to use them. They shouldn't just use one of them. So whether it be CMS or if the Rhode Island Department of Health wants to publicly report, I'd have to use both of them together.
Right. So essentially, you would always report them together. Yeah. Okay. They would not be a composite. You wouldn't get a single score out of it, but you'd always make sure those two measures flow together to be able to look at the issues between them.
More specifically, would the implication be that the baseline dates, you know, if one of the issues is squeezing the tube of toothpaste, you wouldn't want someone to be able to use timing issues. So is that what you mean by reporting together, that they would be drawn from the same data set timing?
I think currently, if you look at the QMs, both of those items are always on the QMs. I don't think that this means that they're going to be linked and there's going to be something that says you have to look at both of these measures. I think the point is that if one of them is going to be reported, both of them must be reported. Regardless of where on the list of QMs they're reported, they both have to appear.
But we would be looking at the same data set and same data timing for the two different measures. Isn't that part of the point, is to keep someone from squeezing the tube of toothpaste by playing with timing or something?
Do we do the same thing with restraints and falls?
I'm going to come back to the other measures as well and talk about it. That's why I table it with her. I want to see the other stuff. So, yeah. So on this one, the always ask the patient, good one. So we'll ask the vendor they want to do it. Recommendation before us is to pair it as before. All abstaining, favor, against. Okay, it passes. To Bill's point, were there any other measures that we did yesterday? Now I got to remember what we did yesterday. That should equally be paired. Restraints or falls? Yes, Alice?
Well, I was just going to say that would be my recommendation, is that falls and restraints be paired. I don't know what we did, to be honest with you, yesterday that would fall into that. We did the injurious falls. I don't know if we talked. I apologize. I'm blanking on the restraint measure. But, yes, I would say restraints and falls should definitely be paired. And if we had talked about both physical and chemical restraints, so psychotropics as well as physical restraints, that there be a pairing.
Could someone remind us? I know we did not approve the two ANA fall indicators. Did we approve any fall indicator?
I believe we approved the injurious fall.
Major
injury. Major injury fall with restraints.
We have numbers.
Yeah.
008 and 21 is the restraints. So it's percent of residents experiencing one or more falls with major injury, long stay, and percent of residents who are physically restrained, long stay.
And are they both from the same data set?
Yes.
Are they all, okay? Because pairing, if they're not from the same data set, makes no sense. You can still game it.
Right.
Just as a just to throw a little point of dissent, we know that neither chemical nor physical restraints reduce falls, and in fact, they probably increase them. So I don't know what the necessary importance of pairing them would be, because if someone thought that they could use restraints to reduce falls, their fall rate is probably going to go up or remain the same. So I think it's a different issue than the other one. I don't really think it's necessary to pair them.
And I agree with you that statistically it does show that the risk of injury is greater with the fall when a restraint is used. I think there was just some concern. I think the interest might be, and maybe this is even a time-limited thing, is that people may attempt to use restraints even though the result would be more injury and more fall. And so the pairing might just be to see how often are people attempting to solve one issue with the other, even though the outcome is going to be more negative, I guess, if that makes any sense.
Actually, I along those lines, I didn't like the fact that we even put the fall measure the restraint measure in the fall section, because it denotes that restraints are somehow tied to falls. Other than restraints really are a quality of life issue. It should be grouped as a quality of life issue outside of that. But that doesn't mean that pairing them aren't maybe important issues around quality of life and other aspects. And since they go together, it doesn't have to be that they're squeezing the toothpaste going different ways. It could be that we still think that they're so important you'd want to pair them together. So that doesn't mean that voting to pair them isn't wrong here. Doesn't that be the rationale for it?
To the vendor, I think, and this may have been a more limited conversation among some of us, but I think there's some evidence that restraints actually lead to more harm falls. Mm-hmm. And so the point I think Alice was making in pairing was, in fact, exactly consistent with what Robert was saying, mm-hmm. is to sort of highlight the linkage that if you think the simple solution is to just bind people in order to reduce harm to them, that you may see increase. Yeah, the literature suggests the inverse, and so that would be the point of pairing. But do you have an opinion on pairing those two?
I would suggest pairing them because I think, you know, until we see the data and we see what the, you know, falls is a new measure. So I think it would be very good and also to remind us to take a look at them together and see which direction that they, you know, which direction that they go, and to be very cognizant of that for us as the developers as well as facilities, and to monitor that. So it makes sense to me to pair them.
Good. And again, part of the definition of pairing is that we're not playing with time frames, that to the extent that we can, we're drawing from the same time frame, even though they're different measures, or do the measures not allow for that in this one like they did with the last one?
I was just going to say that there is a difference here, because with the incontinence measure and the urinary and the catheter measure, if you put in a catheter, you eliminate one person from your incontinence measure. So there really is an effect of one on the other. This is the opposite. You cannot reduce your fall rate by putting restraints on somebody. So you're not going to have the adverse effect on measurement by putting a restraint on somebody as you would by putting a catheter in someone and eliminating them from being measured as an incontinent person. So I think the reasoning between in pairing the two is very different.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it goes away, but I agree.
And the only caveat that I would have is that the falls measure is relatively new, and while I think it's interesting to look at a restraint measure with a falls measure or several falls measures, I wouldn't want to say specifically it should be paired necessarily with this falls measure, because we don't yet know how this falls measure is going to work, since it's new and it's going to be tested.
I'm convinced. Could we recommend seeing if in fact there is a sort of perversity of serious harm when there's an excess of binding people or whatever, yeah, restraints, as opposed to making it a requirement of passing the measure. I think you're right, making it required.
I mean, there is some relationship, of course, to faults and restraints, but I think the type of restraints and where you use it, actually, in terms of all restraints are not bad, you know, they're considered bad, but in terms of falls and injuries, mm-hmm. perhaps it's the restraints used in bed, you know, which may be more harmful than mm-hmm. those which are used in a chair. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some qualification is needed in terms of what kind of physical restraints you want to look at. And we're not talking about falls, actually. The major issue was in the outcome, you know, the indicator was the injury, the major injury. Mm-hmm. And I think the relationship with the major injury and the physical restraints.
So it seems that there's this recommendation not to pair those two?
Not to request,
right.
And analyze the data.
Just to look at, but not necessarily.
You may find that there are that higher restraints and the higher fall is associated with a higher falls measure.
Or higher harm, right.
Higher injury.
I don't believe that requires a vote, though. It's just a nice, friendly recommendation. Yeah. Okay. All right, we're going to start on measures related to nutrition and other functions. So item 24, residents who lose too much weight. And
I was the primary reviewer on this one.
But we need our developer to talk about it first.
I'll ask the same question that Roberta asked earlier, and that is there are three measures in this set. Do you want me to go over all three of them or one at a time?
The first one seems so different than the second two.
Okay.
So and let's just do the weight loss.
Okay, I'll do that initially. But the three measures, what they have in common in this set is that they're longitudinal measures. And the weight loss measure looks at Well, it updates the current MDS 2.0 weight loss measure by adding physician-prescribed weight loss as an additional category in the underlying item and using a two-quarter average for the facility rather than a single quarter to address concerns about seasonal variation. Nursing facility residents often have chronic diseases and functional impairments that present a challenge for proper nutrition and hydration. Residents with weight loss are at higher risk for functional decline, hip fracture, and mortality. And consequences of weight loss may include muscle wasting, infections, and increased risk of pressure sores. The prevalence estimates of poor nutrition and unintentional weight loss among people in institutions vary from 2% to 41%. Using the MDS 2.0 data for April to June of 2009, the national prevalence of too much weight loss in nursing homes was 9.2%, with a range of low from an average of 7% to a high of an average of 11.4%. So to summarize the changes in the underlying items, there is a slight difference between MDO 2.0 and 3.0. In the MDS 3.0 weight loss now, the weight loss has a three response category with the two new ones referring to physician prescribed weight loss. So the response categories are no or unknown, yes on physician prescribed weight loss regimen, or yes not on, on physician prescribed weight loss regimen. And it's only that second one that's used for this measure. The improvement in measurement in this is that as a result of some work that was done by Vince Moore, who found seasonal variation in the measure, the proposed measure uses a two-quarter average for the facility rather than a single quarter. And that summarizes the changes in the measure from the current one.
Seasonal variations, does it go up at Thanksgiving or Christmas? Or wait, what's, yeah.
I looked at this measure, and obviously, having my first career for 35 years being a dietitian, and being a dietitian in long-term care, it is one of those very close to my heart. Mm-hmm. We know that the importance, because of all of the ramifications of poor nutrition, which she alluded to, the increased falls, the increased fractures, certainly impaired skin. So we know that unintended weight loss, you know, it's always been a quality measure, has been for some years. The interest to me is that there is tons and tons of research, and we know about it, yet when you look at the statistics, they haven't gone down any since we started keeping this measure. I would agree that the measure is important, but I think a caveat of that, because I think in the verbiage, it talked about only one area of concern, and I would like to see the consequences of not only poor quality, but certainly of increased mortality, morbidity, and high use of resources also listed. Mm-hmm. Some of the evidence that they reviewed was over 10 years old, but as all of us know, the evidence is there. There was mention of no formally related evidence, but the American Dietetic Association has done some extensive review of unintended weight loss with ratings. It has been measurable information where they looked at different studies. And I think one of the omissions of this information probably was because there was no registered dietitian on the TEP, which I felt was certainly lacking when the dietitians do deal with the nutrition issues much more than most physicians or nurses. There was also no mention of the guidelines done by AMDA. I know that they have those, and I would have liked to have seen those included in some of the references. One of the things that bothered me in the review material was that one of the quotes that was used was from Dr. Morley, that contends that there are minimal intervention studies demonstrating any salutary effect on weight loss. That was the quote they used, but this is kind of beside the point, and I'm not sure of its relevance if we're trying to prevent weight loss, you know, when he says, well, there's nothing to do anyway. So that quote I would have liked not to have been there. I think from a scientific point of view and the usefulness of the information, I think there's some concern for facilities that specialize in end of life or dementia, because their numbers are going to be statistically higher because of their population. So I'm wondering if that couldn't be stratified, you know, the information couldn't be stratified or adjusted to be more beneficial to that segment. Didn't see any other problems with usability. Most of us are using it as a tool to help prevent weight loss or decrease our unintended weight loss in our facilities. And certainly the CMS surveyors and state surveyors are using it to inspect our homes. I didn't see any problems with feasibility at this point either, but I will let Bob was my cohort in crime on this one, so I'll let him discuss anything else that I left out.
I concur. And the only other point, end of life was not an exclusion criteria, and I have mixed feelings about that, because while we often see weight loss in our terminally ill residents, it's not universal. So I wonder, just as a question, whether that might have been why it was not an exclusion factor.
The other issue is we'd have to look at, this was long-term stay, so it goes back to our 100 days that we talked about. And something else I just thought of and I lost it. I think maybe I have dementia. It had to do with dementia, too, unfortunately. Oh, not marking the box because you're not weighing those residents in that are at end of life and you have orders many times. That shouldn't count against you. You know, I don't think, especially if they're in palliative care and you know, they have many times they might have bone cancer and metastasis. And so by moving them, you disturb them and cause them increased pain. So why would you weigh them to begin with? You know what the outcome is. They're losing weight. So I'm not one of these dietitians that demands weekly weights or whatever on residents in end of life.
And I had the same question. I don't know whether in nursing homes, do they classify a patient in the hospice care separately?
There is an item on the MDS 3.0, which is end of life, and I don't have the, I think it's J1400. I'm not sure.
And if it is possible, they can be, if it is possible, then they can be excluded from the...
Yeah, it's J1400. But you know, the problem I have is that not all end-of-life patients need to lose weight. Many of them do. Mm-hmm. And if and this is getting back to Kathleen's point, if you know they're going to lose weight and there are not effective interventions, then there's no point to weighing them. And therefore, there would be no data entered, and I think that should not be held against the facility. But there are many end-of-life patients that, given enough attention and time and in helping them eat, they are able to maintain their weight. So that's why I'm asking whether that was the reasoning behind not having J1400 as an exclusion factor.
That was the sense of the technical expert panel, that the sort of conundrum that you brought up, that because someone is on hospice does not mean that they necessarily have to lose weight.
I've seen, just in my own experience, many Alzheimer's disease victims who are nearing the end. They start losing weight. We pay more attention to them, and all of a sudden they stop losing weight. I would hate to see an indicator exclude them, and therefore the facility feels they don't have to make the same effort, because I think it is possible to, and I think this is a quality of life and comfort issue as well. So I would agree with not having it an exclusion factor.
Robert, are there significant groups of other patients for whom, here's why, let me frame the question. So Diana and I both have said, in the absence of indications to the contrary, leaving it blank should be assumed that you did not comply. And what you're saying is for patients at end of life who are designated in the MDS-3 as end of life, that leaving it blank should not be viewed as a negative. You should drop the patient. But are there not, and this is really my question, are there not other patients besides hospice as defined by the MDS-3 who also you might not want to move to weigh? And so my question is, should the issue that Diana and I have been bringing up just not apply to this measure generally as opposed to only for end of life?
Is lack of data an exclusion in this? I didn't remember.
Yes,
it is. I would probably leave it as such and give the benefit of the doubt to the facilities because, the flip side of this is that some facilities are not very good at regularly weighing patients. And in my, on my other hat is sometimes doing expert review for law firms, sometimes you'll see that weights, somebody just forgot to do it for 6 months. Mm-hmm. But I think in this case, I think we should give it the benefit of the doubt and leave it as is.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm a little uncomfortable with that because, I mean, you can make the same argument for all the other things that we said. There are conceivable reasons why people shouldn't, but it leaves you so open to gaming for, someone could say for those 5 months, that patient was too much in pain to be weighed or something. So I don't know. I mean, I'm really conflicted on this one.
I mean, weight as a measure is, as was pointed out, is hard to do. And many times it's also variable. This inaccurate measurement of weight as well. You see the nursing home charts, weights are going all over the place many times. I wonder if weight loss trend, would be a better measure rather than spot readings of 6 months or 30 days. And certainly, in terms of the end-of-life patients and hospice patients, it depends on the case mix. I think some of the nursing homes, if we have a higher case mix of these end-of-life patients or patients who cannot be weighed or have patients, who are declining despite best efforts, my concern is that they may look badly.
Diana, the difference with this is that this field could potentially cause discomfort to the patient, whereas the other fields, if you leave them blank, it's just an administrative thing. So I hear you, but I think this is slightly different because it has clinical implications to fill it in or not fill it in.
My argument would be either it is perhaps to exclude it, that if we think there's so much leeway in whether you should fill it in or not, perhaps those people likely to have it not filled in should be excluded from the measure.
Well, keep in mind, this measure has been a quality measure already. And to the best of my knowledge, it hasn't been a huge issue of facilities leaving out the information deliberately.
I would also like to remind you about the definition of the measure. A loss of 5% of the resident's body weight during the month prior to the assessment, or a loss of 10% or more in the 6 months prior to the assessment. So that there is a window. It's not, in other words, the resident could miss a couple of weights and still be included in this measure. You'd have to have a lot of missing data in order to exclude them.
And I can say in all my practice, and the facility I work at right now is over 800-bed continuing care retirement community, we maybe have 1%, 2 at the very most, where we would not be weighing that person. It's not a large number of residents who are not weighed. It's just those people that probably we do weigh weekly in the nursing home where I work because that's the demands that the DON and I have. So we weigh all the 100 people that are under SNF and nursing facility care weekly. The only ones that we exclude are those that we know are within probably 4 weeks of expiring, and that we know that it would be very, very uncomfortable for them to be weighed and moved, or, you know, the person that's got 4-plus edema and CHF and can barely breathe, let alone get him to move. So.
And your denominator is large. I mean, your denominator, there's not that many exclusions. So in order to have a significant number of data exclusions, meaning that you couldn't have weighed them for over 6 months, that would not reflect well on the home. And I suspect that after submitting that material, probably the state would ask some questions.
Are we ready to vote? I think the only condition would be the 100-day issue, but it seems like we are agreeing that we would want to keep the exclusions. Okay. All those in favor, raise your hand. No? Abstain? Okay. We'll move on to 22% of residents who need help with activities of daily living has increased. This is a long-stay measure. And would this one make sense mm-hmm. to do the second one also? That would be 23.
Yeah, it would, because any changes to the MDS are consistent with the two. Mm-hmm. So the two measures, they're both long-stay measures. They're both longitudinal measures. The percent of residents whose need for help with activities of daily living has increased updates the current quality measure by using the slightly revised ADL items in the MDS 3.0. The underlying data items in the MDS 2.0 and 3.0 are the same, with minor clarifications. The minor clarifications are the inclusion of two categories: activity occurred only once or twice, or activity did not occur, but they get recoded into total dependence, so essentially it makes no difference in terms of the measurement. These two measures address an important area in the care for older adults in nursing homes, for the residents of nursing facilities. These residents are at risk for functional decline, which is associated with a decreased quality of life. Greater dependency in activities of daily living is a risk factor for negative outcomes, including pressure ulcers and hospitalizations and their associated costs. Using the MDS 2.0 data for April to June of 2008, the national prevalence of increasing need for help with ADLs in nursing facilities was 16.1, with a range from a low of an average of 10.6 to a high of an average of 24.2, so there's indeed variation. As far as the percent of residents whose ability to move in and around their rooms and adjacent corridors got worse, there are the same changes to the MDS 2.0 as with the ADLs, with the inclusion of those two categories. Importance is similar in that immobility increases the risk for unwanted sequelae and an impact on quality of life. The prevalence for this measure was, in terms of mobility decline, the national prevalence was 15.7 with a range of 10.2 in one state and a high of 25.7 in another state. So these are the changes to the measure from the one that's in current use. And I'll be glad to address any other questions.
For 22, there we go. Bill, you're the primary.
Yeah, thank you. And Sister Mary Rose was the secondary. And I think we're broadly in agreement on this. This is obviously a continuation measure. It's just moving it into the 3.0 platform. I think as we reviewed the materials, on each of the points, importance, scientific, usability, feasibility, in all of those areas, if not complete, partial, or somewhere in between, what was significant, I think, or just of note, is that What's consistently noted throughout any or all of those areas is that there's broad consensus about the importance of the measure and the issue, but there are consistently limitations that aren't compelling enough to not advance it. One relates to the sensitivity of it in terms of Medicaid payment policies, practices within states. You know, so it's not just measurement that drives behavior, but it's reimbursement that drives behavior. Naming and acknowledging that limitation in terms of the quality improvement side, or the use of the measure as a CQI tool by facilities, because of what's consistently acknowledged or named, the inability just on the basis of the measure to be able to differentiate decline due to inadequate care as opposed to just unavoidable decline. And then the third, the issue of cognitive impairment, and the relationship of that, and the challenge or the difficulty of being able to risk adjust in relation to that. So those things are all named; they're not necessarily mitigated. But the overarching consideration is that the measure still stands even in the context or in the midst of those limitations. So I'd turn it over to Sister for any other additional comments she might have.
Yes, Bill and I both agreed on that. The only issue that I had was that hospice residents are excluded, and my concern with that was that we have a large population of cognitively impaired residents in our home, and we do see the trend of hospice now starting to come in and be involved with those residents, and just because someone's on hospice doesn't mean their quality of life should shift and we should lose late loss ADLs. I respect hospice. I think they have a big part to play in nursing homes, but when we're looking at this, I think we need to be careful that we don't start excluding that large population that could be a problem. So that was my one concern. And I think we've discussed hospice, that with weight loss and things, it's not necessarily the end. So we need to promote and be proactive, even with our hospice residents. So that's where but I concur with Bill.
Okay, any questions or comments?
I have more angst about this than Bill or Sister Mary Rose as it relates to pay for performance. The problem for me is we cannot endorse and say, but don't use it for pay for performance. That's outside of the scope of what the NQF can do. Not having delved into the sort of details, just looking at what's written in blue on the memory stick that we have, I don't see anything that makes me comfortable that the ability to stratify for nursing homes that have patients who are going to be immobile and might have a higher percentage of them is, maybe you don't need to talk anybody else down, but if you want to, could you try and talk me down that some overzealous administrator isn't going to say, we've got to find 8% in the budget, let's use, if you know there's a patient who's legitimately going to be immobile, or if you know that a nursing home has a high percentage of patients that are going to be immobile, the measure doesn't really, is it fair to compare absolute results on this measure from nursing home to nursing home and to pay different using that? That is my question.
Okay. I was going to ask you to clarify your question because I was having trouble understanding. So you're asking about whether the measure is reliable enough to be able to compare from the performance of one facility versus another facility?
If you take the sample from the MDS-3 mm-hmm. or 2, and I sort of look over to my CMS colleagues, I'm not inclined to say let's keep this secret, but I really think this one brings out the issue of risk stratification or some way to make sure, because we have some on the hospital side that we're going to be dealing with, mm-hmm. That we loved having them out there, but I think we're going to hate initially having them on pay for performance. And so let me add one other thing, because it is a larger issue. I would love to know how the World Health Organization countries, who also are measuring this stuff, deal with this and some of the other measures. I really wish we would not be quite so myopic in our perspective when we look at how others measure. You know, we should try and harmonize with the World Health Organization, but that's a separate issue. On this one, maybe Robert can comment on it, but if this was a pay-for-performance measure, do you start to get cold sweats at night?
Well, you know, I'm looking at some of the information here, and you would expect there to be variability among institutions. According to the University of Colorado study, it says that there was variability, a reasonable degree of variability, but I would think that, I mean, we're not looking for zero here. There's going to be variability among institutions, and you won't flag until you're significantly higher than other institutions. I think that will be somewhat of a bell curve, but according to this, they looked at that and felt that there was some variability, but I don't think that's going to affect the value of the measure. So I mean, you may get one or two facilities here and there that take a particularly vulnerable population susceptible to functional decline, but they don't seem to have found that was more the exception rather than the rule.
So you don't think there's going to be a ton of outliers who cannot control the fact that they're outliers based on the way the measure is done?
No, I think there will be some variability. You're always going to have patients who, residents who have functional decline. That's to be expected to some extent. But I don't think you're going to have an enormous number of outliers unless you have a facility really specializing in very clinically complex residents.
I think that the point that Robert's making is that the ideal number is not zero. Yeah. And that there will be a baseline, that all facilities will probably have a certain number of these people because they do have end-stage dementia. They will have hospice patients. So it's not like you're saying if you're not zero, you're not good. What you're saying is you don't want to be an outlier on the top. And there aren't a lot of places that, you know, sort of specialize in just these people. So.
I think if I could just add one more comment to that when you have a rate-based measure, you're looking at the variation in rates by facilities. And you know, I think, as Dr. Korn said, that they're not going to be zero. It's not as if you're not going to have people whose mobility changes. And in this particular measure, these two measures, risk adjustment we've not found a risk adjustment model that has been useful.
Yeah, I'm pretty deep in the weeds on the statistics. I'm not looking for zero. I'm looking to avoid what Deming called the red beads experiment, where you are doing all these things, but there are factors that are either random, which is the red beads, or completely out of your control as it relates to your population. But as long as the folks who run these centers say, no, we don't think there's going to be a lot of outliers, you know, who for some reason have 30% patients right off the top, then that's you guys.
You know, one other factor with that, and just hearing the conversation prompts me to think about it. There's more than one element or aspect to Medicaid payment policies that potentially have an impact on this and will continue to have an impact on this. It's not just reimbursement to the SNF that people document in relation to, but where you have those variations in payment practices within states or across states, you also have variation in the development of alternative services So the extent to which there's more of a focus on assisted living, on home and community-based services, which is a function of Medicaid dollars and so forth, that's going to impact the population that is then served generally in the skilled facilities in that state. I think that's also a function of the variation, and that's going to be reflected in ADL decline.
What you're saying is there's going to be a systematic impact on that. My experience in this, and I waver a little bit on whether I should name names, so I won't. When evaluating one of the world famous heart center open heart surgery rates, by most risk adjustment methodologies, this one center looks wonderful. But when you sort of dig under the hood, you discover that more than close to two-thirds of their open-heart surgery patients are traveling from all over the country to get there. So the patients, the one-third of MI patients whose first symptom is death or trauma are out of the sample, and risk adjustment, at least early risk adjustment, wasn't fully capturing that. I just think at a minimum we should, on this measure, say there's some real cautionary issues about including it in a bundle that goes toward reimbursement. But I know we can't do that. That's enough for now.
One of the points that I think is important in terms of especially looking at outliers and expected functional loss is that the way you've structured this, it focuses on four specific ADLs. It's not all ADLs, so it doesn't include mobility, and it's looking specifically at the ones that tend to be lost last, so the ones that are preserved. And so I think that focus helps to narrow that gap somewhat, and I think that will help with this measure. I think it strengthens it, and I'd also strongly support Sister Mary Rose's point. I think hospice needs to be included.
And the other thing is that most people that are in a proactive program are preventing these late loss, so there's payment on the other end that you're getting. So it's a wash across the board if you really, so a good facility should be not here. Yeah, should not be here.
Let me see if I can summarize that. I think it's approved measure as is, except for the 100-day, and remove the hospice exclusion. Is that a condition or a recommendation? Recommendation, to look at what it would mean to do that and the pros and cons of it. Okay. So condition, close the 100-day loophole, recommendation to look at the hospice removing. All in favor? Abstaining? Opposed? Okay. On to number 23.
Yes, under the measure specifications, first of all, I had a lot of issues with this particular measure. The measure reads, percent of residents whose ability to move in and around their room and adjacent corridors got worse. However, the numerator that they're looking at is locomotion on unit, which reads how resident moves between locations in his or her room and adjacent corridor on the same floor. If in a wheelchair, self-sufficiency once in the chair. So the part of the title of the measure that talks about the ability to move in and around the room isn't even addressed, because that's a different question on the MDS 3.0 altogether. Secondly, with regard to this, the issue that I have with regard, and I was kind of hoping it would be fixed in the 3.0, but it apparently was not something that was meant to be, is it looks at equally if the resident can do this ambulatory or any wheelchair. It's their self-sufficiency. So if you have a resident who is extensive assistance in locomotion on the unit, ambulating with extensive assistance, and the next assessment, they are now extensive assistance, but they are in a wheelchair, there is no change to this code. So that decline is never captured on this issue of the MDS. And, of course, the reverse is true as well. If the resident required extensive assistance in a wheelchair and improved to the point of being extensive assistance ambulating, and as far what I learned in nursing school is walking is always better than riding, except when you're going to town, that incline itself was also not recognized in this, so that you have a lot of I just found that to be a big issue, that this particular numerator gets very, very messy. Also, as was stated by CMS, it did add the number seven, as it happened one or two times. The seven and the eight get rolled into the four, which is extensive assistance for the intent of this measure. However, in the eyes of PPS, that in the seven and the eight equals an independent. So there will be disparities between any public reporting of the quality measure as it relates to this and that information as it relates to when they post any PPS statistics. The other issue I have is that it talks about just a one-level decline. So if a resident is independent and three times in over a 24-hour period times 7 days they required queuing, that is a decline. In the late loss one that we talked that was talked about earlier, the nice thing they did is they talked about a two-level decline in one late loss ADL or one-level decline in multiple ADLs. It would have been nice if they would have looked at the independent and supervision, like maybe from a decline from a 0 or 1 to a 2 or a decline from a 2 to a 3 or something like that to take into respect. Because I tell you what, if you did an MDS on me today, I would have declined in my locomotion on unit based in needing queuing over the last 7 days on where my room was. Sorry about that. Just for in the so in the denominator.
That was you in the lobby
last
night?
Huh?
That was you in the lobby all night last night?
I have been in so many hotels and tried to get in so many wrong rooms. It's just unreal. The other thing that is, and we do talk about, they do exclude residents who are already at a level of total dependence because they can't really decline any further than that. Adding the seven and the eight. They also do exclude residents who are comatose, life expectancy of less than 6 months, or receiving hospice. Again, I think that because it's a one-level decline, it constitutes a decline. I think we have a problem with, I don't know what the current term is. We used to call them the old, the residents that are in their 90s and that you're going to see that slight decline just as part of aging. Mine happens to happen in the 50s, but most other people, it's in the 90s, that there's no exclusion for that. So I felt that this was minimally met at best with regard to the scientific area. As it relates to usability, because there is so much noise in that particular number of not knowing residents who improved or declined based on the appliance they're using as part of their self-sufficiency, and that, and also in the measure itself, they just basically in this area talked about the fact that, well, we already have one, so, you know, there wasn't any proof as to how this measure by itself is very usable. I don't see it's usable because you have to dig through it too much to find the noise, get rid of the noise, to find the meat of what you want. Although I do believe that the idea of being able to somehow identify a resident's a change in their mobility is very important. I don't believe that this measure, the way that it is written, what with data we can get out of there, is meeting that point. As regards to feasibility, I mean, the fact that it is feasible, it's in the 3.0. We have a way of sending the data. It's just that it's not very usable, and the fact that they did identify that there would be so many inconsistencies and errors based on that. So as far as me personally, I don't propose this measure be continued. I don't remember you talked yesterday. Someone talked about the fact there's going to be some functional, there's going to be some kind of a group that's going to be looking at functional, and I think that this needs to go there. We need a group that looks at how to handle those kinds of things. I don't recommend this measure. Diana was my co-reviewer, so I'll turn it over to her.
Right, and It was just really painful to see their validity and reliability testing of this measure. I mean, not that they did it very well, but the results. Because, I mean, this is a very highly risk-adjusted measure. And, you know, basically the people who did it pretty well. And I will quote what they said. This is their R squared, which is sort of